People and organizations rely on the cloud to do many of the things they care most about. Communicating with family and friends, or business partners and customers. Storing and sharing important personal and professional documents. The benefits of the cloud are profound. It connects us to things we care most about, creates new opportunities, and dramatically increases capability and lowers cost for businesses. Despite its name, the cloud has a physical presence. It is, in reality, a series of data centers around the world, housing millions of powerful computers that make these things possible. This data is your data, just as the data on your hard drive is yours. But it resides in data centers managed by technology companies. Microsoft's data center located in Dublin, Ireland, has been getting a lot of attention. The US government served Microsoft with a search warrant seeking to compel us to provide email content stored exclusively in the Dublin data center. Microsoft is resisting this warrant on the grounds that digital content should have the same privacy protections as physical content. The US government would not attempt to travel to another country and execute a search warrant. The approach shouldn't change just because that content is stored digitally. We believe the government's approach is ultimately putting the privacy rights of Americans at risk and challenging the ability of people around the world to rely on the privacy protections of their own governments and laws. It risks undermining trust in technology. The US has other means to request the data it seeks through established treaties with Ireland and other countries. The case highlights broader concerns. Privacy laws in the US and in other places around the world have not kept pace with technology. Rather than update those laws, governments are stretching the boundaries of old laws in the name of security. Governments play a vital and difficult role in keeping communities safe. But the laws around the world need to strike a better balance between security and privacy. That's one reason that we brought this case, and why we believe the US government and other governments need to introduce reforms.
Good morning. My name is Charlie Gibson. I used to be a television host. I used to be a television anchor. I used to be a television reporter. I don't know what in the world I am today. But I'm going to be sort of the wrangler today. If you're here today, or if you're watching on a computer screen somewhere, either in Europe or Washington State or Washington City, then we're going to presume that you know a good deal about this case and operate on the assumption that you know the particulars and the issues that lie behind it. In the matter of a warrant to search a certain email account controlled and maintained by Microsoft Corporation. That's not a very catchy title. I think maybe 50 Shades of Privacy might get more attention. Microsoft and those companies or organizations who support its position on one side and the government on the other obviously have vastly different views of this case. A quotation that was at the very top of the magistrate judge James Francis's decision last April came from the Stanford Law Review, and I think it is something probably that everybody can agree on. That quotation is, "The rise of an electronic medium that disregards geographic boundaries throws the law into disarray by creating entirely new phenomena that need to become the subject of clear legal rules." And the hope is that this case will produce clear legal rules that establish lines weighing people's right to privacy against the government's right to investigate potential crimes. Both sides make powerful points. We're going to try to explore some of them today. Microsoft has convened this meeting today, and you'll hear a lot about their point of view. But in questions, I'm going to try and present some of the government's points as well. If you have followed the case, you are acquainted with Brad Smith. He is the Executive Vice President, General Counsel of Microsoft, and he's going to start with some remarks about why he wanted to bring you all together today here in this room and those who are watching on the web. Brad.
Well, thank you, Charlie, and thank you to those of you who are here with us in New York or are watching in Washington, D.C., in Brussels, in Washington State, literally around the world. Let me just take a few moments to set the context for some of this, building on the video and Charlie's comments. In a sense, we're here today to talk about the latest chapter in a story that has literally been unfolding for over two centuries. It's really the story about the intersection between changing technology and the need to keep the public safe and also protect people's privacy. It's a story that began in some ways when Benjamin Franklin founded the post office. People sent their letters in the mail, and law enforcement needed to investigate what criminals invented as a response, which was mail fraud. In the 1800s, people invented the telegraph. Criminals invented wire fraud. Law enforcement needed to investigate it. In the last 30 years, we saw the rise of the computer and then the internet. And lo and behold, today we have internet fraud, internet crime. And just as in the past, the question for our generation is how to strike the balance between strong privacy and public safety in an era where technology continues to change. That story today brings us not only to New York, but to the story about email that is stored in Microsoft's data center in Dublin. It's in Dublin for a reason. It's because we tend, like most tech companies, to store email and other private communications in a data center that is closest to the customer. So for example, when we have a customer who is based in Europe, we store their email in Europe. That way they're able to access it faster and more securely. Of course, all of this creates issues. And one of these issues began literally a year ago this week. That's when Microsoft went to court to contest the search warrant issued by the United States government to access and obtain the email that is stored in Dublin. Now, last Monday, we at Microsoft filed our brief in this legal case. It's a brief that gave us the opportunity to point out that while this may be a story and a case about Ireland, it's also a case about the rights of Americans. Because if the United States government, after all, takes a certain approach and reaches into data centers in other countries, we have to assume that other governments will follow, and they'll do the same thing. And when they are interested in the email of Americans stored in the United States, we will have a difficult precedent with which to grapple. It's also a case that raises important questions about the rights of people in other countries. Will they continue to have their privacy rights protected by their own laws? And fundamentally, it really raises the question, how do we think about email? Or text messages, or photos, or all the documents that we create. Because unlike the mail that you put in a letter and entrust to the government in the form of the Postal Service, the US government has argued in this case that your email, when stored in the cloud and located in the data center, ceases to belong to you alone. Instead, it becomes a business record of a tech company as well, with profound implications, as you'll hear this morning. Now, last week was our brief. The reason we're here today is because this is the day when a number of groups are filing their amicus, or friend of the court, briefs. 10 briefs are being filed today. And even in the final hours, as more entities are signing on to some of these briefs, it's already clear that 28 tech and media companies are signing on to support these briefs. 35 leading computer scientists from 20 universities have submitted a brief. You'll hear a short video from Ed Lazowska, one of the professors who's involved in that brief, explaining their point of view on some of the technology questions. And there are signatories in the form of 23 different trade associations and advocacy groups, associations that represent literally millions of people and companies on both sides of the Atlantic. All of these briefs make one thing abundantly clear. This is a case that involves not just a narrow legal issue, but a broad public policy issue that is fundamental to the future of technology in a global economy. And that's really why we organized this event this morning. It's an opportunity for people to begin to hear a little bit more about the wide array of interests that are at stake. And indeed, as you'll see in the briefs that are being filed today, this is an issue that has now brought together people from a cross-section of groups. You see tech companies who are concerned about the impact on trust in American technology and the rights of customers. There are briefs from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers, concerned about what this means for the future of businesses' ability to rely on the cloud. There are civil liberties groups concerned about what the case means for the constitutional and statutory protection of privacy rights. There are media and news organizations concerned about what this means for the ability of journalists to protect their email and ultimately shield their sources from government access and investigation without their news organizations knowing about it. And there are European groups who have an obvious concern about what this means for the privacy protection of people who live in Ireland and across the European Union. Ultimately, though, this is a part of an ongoing conversation. And one of the things that is always important for us at Microsoft, I think, to underscore is that we recognize that it is a conversation that is not all about one side being right and the other side being wrong. It's about safety and privacy. And I think most of us would share the view that we want to live in a world that values both and finds a way to develop new solutions. Those solutions may come from the court, or they may come from the Congress, or they may come from the White House. And one of the things we'll have a chance to talk a little bit about this morning is what some of those solutions may look like as well. It's why this is an important conversation. And it's why the day where we're filing and seeing the filing of amicus briefs, a day that ordinarily doesn't attract as many headlines, in this instance, really creates a very powerful opportunity to talk not just about the narrow and the immediate, but the broad and the long term as well. So as I said, thank you very much. Thank you, Charlie. We look forward to this conversation.
Okay, thank you. We're gonna have a couple of panels. I should introduce the members of the first panel who have jumped on stage here. Victoria Espinel is President and CEO of BSA, the Software Alliance, and Andrew Pincus is a partner at Mayer Brown Law Firm, an advisor to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers. The two panels are going to be about an hour, so if you're here in the room, we'll get you out to lunch. If you're watching in Europe, we'll get you out to dinner. If you're watching in Washington State, we'll get you to breakfast. And if you're in Guam, you're just out of luck, I guess. I don't know. Brad, you've lost two rounds in this case. You lost at the magistrate level. You lost at the district court level. So why don't you give them the damn emails?
The amazing thing about a court case like this is the only thing that matters is who wins the final round. So I think that's the short story. The principle is important, and this case has a long ways to go.
And it seems to me, as I look at this as a journalist, that the results of this particular case may not be as important in the long run as the basis on which it is decided and what the long-term rules that may be promulgated here will be. You're basing your argument on two things. You base your argument on the fact that that you shouldn't have to turn over the content of emails held physically in another country. Mm-hmm. And second, you base your argument, not so heavily publicized, although you mentioned it a moment ago, on whether personal emails constitute business records or whether they're the really sole possession of the person who was the correspondent. In all seriousness, though, you base your argument that the data physically is overseas. But this is a whole new world that has arisen since the operative law here that applies. Nobody has to go to Ireland to get it. It can be just retrieved by a simple keystroke. So really, it isn't a search and seizure in Ireland, is it?
Well, that is an argument that the government makes. We absolutely believe it is a search and seizure in Ireland. We store this data in a physical place, and we don't choose the place at random. We choose it because it is where the customer is located. And that's important for the way the technology works. Frankly, it's also important for the protection of people's rights. One thing you see around the world is everybody wants to have their rights protected by their own law. Try telling an American that their rights are no longer going to be protected by the Constitution, they're no longer going to be protected by U.S. law, they're going to be protected by Irish law or Chinese law or Brazilian law. People are not entirely happy about that for lots of good reasons, and that principle too is at stake here.
But isn't it rather happenstance where you happen to store it? You store it near perhaps where the correspondent is. And I can certainly envision a world where if somebody felt that they had dicey emails that they didn't want the U.S. government to look at, they'd go and say, I want you to store it overseas. Put it overseas so that the government can't get it.
And no, that's a very good point. And, you know, it's why we need to know where people are. You know, and it's why we've said throughout, look, if this were a matter of Americans trying to evade U.S. law by claiming to be a nationality that they're not, or claiming to live in a place where they've never been, that would be a different question. And we do need legal rules that address those situations as well. But for the sake of those needs, should we put the rights of the people in Ireland at risk? Should we tell Europeans that they're now subject to U.S. law? Should we tell Americans in the future that they're subject to the law of some other country? That doesn't feel like the best way to strike the right balance.
Judge Preska, in her decision in the Second Circuit, said nothing in the text or structure of the statute carves out an exception for records stored overseas. Further, quote, there is no overseas search here.
Well, there's two different concepts there. And the first is actually a point, frankly, we would say in our favor. There's a principle of law in the United States that exists for good reason. The principle is that no law passed by Congress applies outside the territory of the United States unless Congress explicitly says that it will. And Congress did not say so here, as that quote basically reflects. And there's a good reason for that principle. If Congress just passed a law and didn't even have to think about it, and suddenly it's applying in Europe or in South America or in Africa, you can imagine the impact on the foreign relations of the United States. So, in fact, given that Congress did not intend, did not say that this law would apply outside the United States, settled principle would say that it
does
not.
But, Brad, it's a 1986 law. It's the Electronic Security Act, or the Electronic Storage Act.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm not conversant totally with it. It was passed in 1986. Nobody had a clue that we were going to have something like the cloud in that days, or that you could simply put an email in Ireland and with a keystroke retrieve it. So, yes, they didn't specifically say that this would apply overseas, but they also didn't specifically say that it wouldn't apply overseas, and the courts found that there is precedent for saying that it can apply overseas.
Well, actually, the law was passed in 1986. It's been amended in small ways since, in ways that made clear that it applied on a nationwide basis, so that a district court in one district could issue a warrant and it would be applied in other districts across the country. And Congress chose to use that word nationwide for a reason. It didn't say internationally. It didn't say globally.
But wasn't that for issuance of a warrant or subpoena, that it could be done nationwide as opposed to actually applying to a search?
Well, you can't execute a warrant to obtain information without searching for it. So, you know, it's hard to have a seizure without a search preceding it. The two basically go hand in hand. And the fundamental question here is both how to strike the right balance between what are clear-cut needs for public safety and personal privacy, and of course also who should strike the right balance. We all live in a country where at the moment we are plagued by more gridlock than almost anyone would think is a good thing. That is self-evident. It is a problem, and we would be among the first to acknowledge that. But nonetheless, we have a constitution that obviously predates the year 1986 by almost literally 200 years. There are certain values that have served us well over time. And frankly, one of the values that has served us well is for these kinds of broad issues to be addressed by the Congress, to be addressed by the White House, and then for the courts to interpret the law rather than to try to add to it in ways that go beyond their traditional role.
I don't want to leave the two of you out. You have both the organizations that you represent have filed amicus briefs, basically supporting the position of Microsoft. But on this question, I guess in my old role, I'm trying to make you the experts that I would throw in a soundbite in the middle of the piece. But is it as simple as what Brad says? Because it's in Ireland, this law can't apply, and their privacy of those correspondence, email correspondence, needs to be protected? Or are we in a technological world now where, because you can simply retrieve this information in New York, one guy sitting at a computer can get this information, that it's a whole new ballgame?
Well,
so I would say a couple of things. One is, you pointed out already that the age of some of the laws that we're operating under, and technology moves very quickly. So I think if you think about it, it's not surprising that the laws that we have on the books today are outdated and outmoded for the world that we live in today. And that's why the software industry has been pushing the U.S. Congress to reform the laws that are on the books today so that they are in sync with both the technology and with our values. And hopefully Congress will move on that. But to the question you just asked, I think one of the things that we need to think about, and my background at an earlier point in time was at a trade negotiator, and so I'm well aware of the fact that other countries look to the United States as an example, as a good example or as a bad example. And I think we need to think very carefully about the precedent that could be set here. And we need to think about what this means, not just in terms of what U.S., what the Department of Justice wants to do overseas, but what that might mean for other governments who might see this. I think, frankly, almost definitely will see this as a precedent to reach into the email of Americans. And so I think this case is very important for the privacy of U.S. citizens, but we need to think about it in a global context and the precedent that this sets for citizens around the world. And I think, as Brad said, we could talk maybe a little bit later on about some of the solutions there.
We will.
But I think keeping in mind the risk that this case brings in terms of undermining trust on both sides of the Atlantic is a very important part of this.
Andy? I think as a legal matter, it really is that simple. I mean, if you think about the pre-digital era, if some bank that operated in the U.S. also had a branch in Ireland and somebody had documents in their safe deposit box in Ireland, no one in the world would think that by serving a document on the bank here, the U.S. government could get those, force the bank to retrieve those documents and send them over.
But that's where everything has changed. That's a physical piece of paper that you have to go in and get out of a safe deposit box or a safe or whatever. This is not.
But here's the key, I think. That change, and you're right, technology has changed a lot. And the question is, should that change in technology automatically, without anyone thinking about it, affect a huge expansion of the U.S. government's power at the expense of other nations? Because if you think about it, that's what's happening here. And I think there's a really good analogy in the cell phone case that the Supreme Court decided last year, because the government's arguments here are so similar. There, as people probably know, the argument was when someone's arrested, the government has, or the police have a right to search your person. If they have a wallet, they can look inside. And the government said, well, if you have a cell phone, we can download the entire digital content. Same thing, we're just searching what's on your body. And the Supreme Court said, well, in some very remote sense, that's true, but the amount of information that the government would get by sort of mindlessly applying that same principle to this digital environment is vast and would undermine what the Fourth Amendment is trying to do. And so the Supreme Court said, we're not going to apply that rule in this mindless way to digitally store data. Here, the government is saying, we're not doing anything outside the U.S., so we get the benefit of the old warrant rules that said, oh, if you're in the U.S., you're fine. But in the same way, of course they're doing something outside the U.S. in any real sense, and I think the same rationale really compels the conclusion that courts shouldn't do this. As Brad said, if there's an adjustment to be made, there's a lot of weighing of privacy interests, foreign relations interests that has to be taken account of. But to sort of just say we're going to shoehorn this into this old rule because Microsoft happens to be in the U.S. really makes a dramatic change.
The other quick thing I would add is, look, the world migrated away from all communication being on paper to other forms of technology, not in the 21st century, but in the 19th. When the telegraph was invented, we went from paper to basically electrical impulses that could be intercepted in different ways, that crossed over wires, there was a transatlantic cable. And fundamentally what the people of that era needed to decide was what did technology change versus what were the values that they wanted to see endure. And this is the newest form of that question being asked in ways that may seem different and in some ways not so much.
Well, let me get off into ground where I'm in or I may be not on steady ground here. What if ISIS decided to store all of its emails, and I presume they do some communication that way, with Microsoft and said, put them in Ireland? Would you still deny the U.S. government the right to?
Well, and this goes to Victoria's point. We need solutions, and we need solutions that work. And there are multiple solutions that work. One of them is an existing agreement between the United States and Ireland.
But you know the government says that's cumbersome, it takes too much time, and it's not definite that it'll work. And there are also countries where we don't have these agreements.
Sure, but let's start. We can decide where we're going to build data centers. The whole industry can. And you know, the industry can build data centers in countries that have proper legal regimes, and that's the kind of thing that definitely is a consideration. First of all, there's a convention under which basically a government can apply for an order to freeze all of the email, and it's basically done instantaneously. So you don't have to worry about the email being destroyed. Second, in the case of Ireland, for example, we've produced evidence in this case from a former Irish attorney general who said that the Irish move very quickly. They seldom, if ever, turn down the United States government. Of course, you imagine these situations, governments are going to want to move quickly. They can move as fast as they want. And in addition, let's just think about the opportunity that we all have to move these treaties into the future. I mean, look, we live in a world where in the wake of 9/11, we first found that it was difficult to move people just through an airport. And then people realized that you had trusted travelers. They could say, they could qualify for pre-clearance, and they could move forward quickly.
So you're fine if the Irish government said, okay, come on in, get the emails. You just don't want Microsoft to be the organ that turns them over.
If the Irish government acts, then you preserve a world where you have laws in both places and governments that can work together. And just put the shoe on the other foot. If a government abroad needs data that's in the United States, we as Americans would want U.S. law and the U.S. government to be involved. You can't blame other people for feeling the same way.
The other part of this is critical, and I want all three of you to comment on this, which is the really interesting argument to me. The government argues that emails are business records and that therefore, because of pre-existing law, again, back into the early 80s, that you have an obligation to turn over business records. You argue these are entirely personal communications that belong only to the communicant. And yet the courts have sided with the government on that in both instances. Comment on it. So
I would say, going back to something that Brad had alluded to before, I think the government can't say our process is cumbersome. We have a process that doesn't work very well, and so therefore we're going to take an outdated law and we're going to apply it to the circumstances of today. If we need to have a new process, and I believe that we do, then we need to figure out what that new process is, and we can talk more about that later. But I think it's an important point to make. In terms of the government's argument with respect to business records, I would just say, I think people, individual human beings, and companies store a lot of information in the cloud. And they store some information that they might be fined for made public, and they store a lot of information that is confidential. And I think they believe it to be confidential, and I think they are appropriate in being able to have the trust that it will be kept confidential. And so I think saying that because you have confidential information you put in the cloud, it's no longer yours, and it now belongs to the tech company that stores it, I think that is very much at odds with what people would believe to be true and certainly what people would believe to be right.
Andy, you're not.
Well, I'll give you an economic answer and a legal answer as well. I think in terms of the promise of cloud technology, which we haven't talked that much about, but we should, this is a revolution in terms of efficiency in data processing, in the lowering significantly companies' costs of managing their data, because it's all pooled in one huge economy of scale. So, but companies and certainly people aren't going to do that if it means they lose control over their proprietary information. I mean, think about it from the company perspective. Your intellectual property, your business plans, the legal records about your lawsuit or about the merger that you're thinking about, if by putting them in the cloud you lose control over them and the government just gets access whenever it wants, nobody's going to do that. And
Brad,
so that economic benefit is lost.
Brad, I wonder if you'd rename the cloud if you had a chance to do it. Because it's kind of a woo-woo word that sounds sort of soft and out there. It's like a soft toilet paper or something.
Yeah.
And yet you're arguing this is hard information that exists in a place and it's in Ireland, whatever. What would you call it instead of cloud?
Well, first of all, you raise a very valid point, and ours is an industry that basically renamed the mouse, renamed the virus, renamed spam, and guess what? We renamed the weather as well. And I do think it's a challenge because it makes it seem more ephemeral than it is. And what we are dealing with is hard information stored in a single location. And the real issue here, because this is fundamental, is just the way the government's argument actually turns fundamental principles upside down. Your telephone bill is a business record. The government can get it by filing a subpoena with the telephone company. But your telephone call is not. It's a personal communication, and it's entitled to greater legal protection. Your hotel bill is a business record. But if you are staying in New York and you came here this morning and you left your clothes and you're in the closet and your documents on the desk, the hotel needs to respect that that's your personal possession. Same for email.
Let me turn to something slightly different. Some have pointed out that if the government wins this case, that that's a problem for privacy rights, but it's also a big problem for the U.S. tech market, because people overseas, governments or individuals, will be very wary of putting their information in the hands of an American company. That's a lot of money for you. I've seen one estimate, it was in a organ called Information Week, that the U.S. domestic cloud companies, this is a $45 billion business, a $45 billion business that could be at risk. So are your arguments totally high-minded, Brad, or are they very much concerned with the bottom line for Microsoft?
It's a completely fair and appropriate question, and the answer is they're both. Of course, the entire tech sector, which Victoria represents, understands that this is about this country's ability to continue to basically create technology that leads the world and has access to the global market. Because if we lose, we expect foreign governments, as we're already seeing, are going to lay down more rules that will basically prohibit or prevent or make it more difficult for us to serve their customers. And it is about economics, but it also is about a fundamental principle. Ultimately, it's about trust. So I like to say tech companies have become a bit like banks. You wouldn't put your money in a bank if you weren't confident that it would be there when you wanted to withdraw it. You're not going to put your data in a data center or the cloud run by an American company if you don't have confidence about who can and cannot get access to it.
Go ahead.
So clearly there are fundamental privacy concerns here, which we've discussed, and there are clearly significant business interests that are at risk as well. And I think the two things are very much linked, because you need trust in business the way you need trust in international relations, the way you need trust in your personal relations. Trust is a fabric that makes things work. And if that trust is being undermined, and I think this case very much puts that at risk, that's a real problem. But I would also say, there are real business risks today. I think this case, or the outcome of this case, could have a real impact today. We represent 3 million jobs in the United States. But a point that I'd like to make clear, because I think this is really important, is it's not just about damage to the American economy. I think that's an issue, but I think it's bigger than that. We are all in this global world together, and I think the impacts would ripple beyond that. You talked about the cloud and the benefits that come from it. I think one of the things we haven't talked about yet, but we really need to make sure that we do, is the fact that this will, I believe, make companies and individuals much more reluctant to use the cloud for good reason. And that has real implications. There was economists recently did an estimate that if companies, so just talking about companies here, not even individuals, if companies use data services and use cloud services to become just 1% more efficient, which is actually probably vastly less than they do, so just taking 1% is a very conservative estimate, that will add $15 trillion to the global economy in 15 years. That is an enormous lost opportunity if companies start pulling back from cloud and from all the computing capacity that brings, because they have concerns about how their information is going to be treated.
Andy?
Well, I was going to make the point Victoria did, which is this is certainly tech companies are on the front line, but this really is the whole economy, because these efficiencies ripple through the economy. It means that there are billions more money to invest in new products or jobs that previously were being spent on data processing, data management services that are now cheaper because of the cloud. And so to say, for the U.S. government to say we are going to adopt a legal rule that is going to significantly discourage companies from doing that is going to hurt not just tech companies, but the whole economy.
Brad, what percentage of people storing emails in Microsoft system come from overseas?
It's a great question. I don't know the precise answer, but I can tell you that at roughly 60% of our business today is with customers outside the United States. One question I always like to ask myself, or the fact I like to remind myself every morning, 96% of the people in the world live outside the United States. So if you want the American tech sector to serve the world, you have to appreciate that 96% of our customers eventually will be outside the United States.
I ask that question as predicate, really, because obviously you're worried about whether foreigners will lose confidence in the system if the government prevails. Would you be fighting so hard if there weren't a crisis of confidence after Edward Snowden?
I will say no and yes. No, you know, we would of course devote our resources on any day of the week on the problems that are most pronounced. And I would be sort of naive or, you know, in less than genuine to say otherwise. But I will say, yes, we would in important ways as well. You know, we've dealt with this tension, you know, since the early days of our company. We dealt with it in the days after 9/11. At the time, it was not public. Some of this has become public because of the disclosures of the last 18 months. So, you know, we've sought to really think hard about how to be principled, and principled in a way that serves public safety and protects fundamental privacy rights, regardless of how much attention this is getting.
So let me turn to the, you mentioned we should talk about potential solutions. Are there solutions that would satisfy the privacy rights, would satisfy the government's access to information, that would protect Americans from foreign incursion into our emails? Is there a way to do that? Some people have suggested a legislative solution. Is there a way to do it?
I think that could be part of it. So first of all, I think there has to be a way to do that, right? There has to be a way that we can balance the values that we believe in with helping law enforcement do its job to protect us all. That conversation and that balancing has been going on.
Well, there has to be a way from
there
your mouth.
There has to be a way
from your mouth to God's ears. What is it?
But I would say, and I think there's at least three things that solution has to do. One, it has to be clear and predictable. I think at best we are in a situation right now where there is a grave lack of clarity, and that is bad for everyone.
Clear legal rules.
I think it has to be international. You mentioned the U.S. Congress, and certainly we have work to do here at home in terms of reforming our own system. We have been and will continue to push very hard for that. But I think it has to be an international consensus. So it has to be something that comes from the international community. And I think while it comes from the international community, I do think it has to be a solution that is consistent with American values of due process and civil liberty.
And there really are. I mean,
I just want to underline
what so, Brett said before. There really are solutions in existence now. I mean, the idea that we have to build something totally new, I think is just not right. There are these bilateral agreements between the U.S. and Ireland. If the structure isn't there to have an immediate request for data to the Irish authorities that's immediately acted upon, it's not rocket science to put that in place. And there is this international convention on cybercrime that has very specific mechanisms for solving just this problem. How does country A get electronic data that is in country B? And there are literally 24/7 mechanisms so that that data can be frozen and then gotten very rapidly. So this is not reinventing the wheel is not the problem here.
And I would say in terms of bringing the international community together, that is always difficult to do. I was a former trade negotiator. I've been in a lot of trade negotiations. I know how hard they can be. I would say one advantage we have here.
You can't get the international community to agree that it's Tuesday.
I think this is something where there is a real eagerness and a real hunger to have a solution. So unlike being in a negotiation where one side wants to be there and the other side really doesn't, which is always a very difficult negotiating dynamic, I think this is, perhaps with a few countries as exceptions, I think this is an issue where you could find a broad swath of the international community that was willing to come together and find a process that works because it's so important.
Yeah, and I would say, wait a second. Of course you can't get the international community degree. It's Tuesday because it's Monday.
Well, but I'm retired. Okay. So I said to somebody the other day, my life is six Saturdays interrupted by a Sunday. So
this is definitely Tuesday. But more to the point, you may not be able to get every government to agree, but do we really think we can't reach an agreement with the government of Ireland? You know, do we really think we can't reach an agreement with the United Kingdom or with Germany? I mean, you know, our governments have collaborated on vital issues of national security for decades. Why is this so much harder than everything else that we've been able to work on? Why don't we at least start? I mean, it's very easy to say a problem is insurmountable if no one tries to solve it. And fundamentally, that's our call. It's let's work together and see what we can do.
You made mention in your prefatory remarks that there are various ways that this problem can be attacked. It can be attacked in the Congress. We mentioned that the laws which govern here are outmoded because they were passed in the early 80s or mid-80s. You mentioned that Congress could act. You mentioned that the White House could intercede in this case. But your immediate imperative is that you have a court case proceeding. Mm-hmm. But what would you have the... given the perfect world where Congress did something, and that's somewhat at odds these days, but given the perfect world that Congress did something, what would you have them do?
Well, I think there's actually a very good piece of legislation introduced a few months ago in the Senate by Senators Hatch, Heller, and Coons. And basically what it would affirm is that ordinarily this law does not reach outside the United States, but it would create an exception so that if you have an American citizen or a U.S. resident who somehow manages to store his or her email outside the United States, then in that instance it would reach that contents. And I think that's a rule that other governments could get comfortable with and
citizen.
Understand. Yeah, an American citizen, if it's in Ireland, the U.S. law could still reach it. The other thing the law does is call on the executive branch to do what we're asking for here, which is let's focus on these treaties and let's figure out how we modernize them.
So that, in your world, you would say, in your perfect world where Congress does something, I still can't get my head around that concept, but if Congress would say, all right, American emails overseas can be accessed by American governmental jurisprudence or by governments who were pursuing it, but foreign governments cannot reach into the United States. They can't govern what foreign governments would do, but it would set a precedent in your mind that would keep foreign governments from coming in and accessing the emails of United States citizens.
Exactly. It would protect fundamentally the rights of Americans.
How about encryption? Is encryption the solution here? If people encrypted their own emails, would that take care of the problem?
Encryption definitely is important. It protects in a wide array of scenarios. Ultimately, one of the big questions that I think we'll find we're all spending more time talking about 2 and 3 and 5 years from now is what happens when email or other data is encrypted and the service provider doesn't have the key to decrypt
it. Right. Right.
And, you know, obviously that's where things have been going the last few years. That's gotten a lot of attention. In many ways, I would argue that the two biggest challenges to law enforcement in the United States are not the position we're taking in this case, but it's number one, what they'll do if foreign governments don't even allow us to operate data centers in other countries because of concerns about this kind of law. Or number two, how will they navigate a world where there is more encryption and they're not able to get the key from anyone? And you know, one of the points we consistently make is if everyone wants to avoid an arms race in the technology space, there's only one way to avoid it. It's arms negotiations that lead to better laws. And so all of these things actually come back and intersect.
Final word, we're out of time. Final word from each of you.
Well, I just to echo what Brad said, I think governments have a choice here. One is to create laws that give their citizens confidence that there will be protection and due process before their information can be accessed. Because if those aren't in place, then self-help through encryption really is the only choice.
You're going to get the final word?
I think you talked about technology solutions, and I think that's an important part of the discussion. I think turning to the tech companies to find the solution here is suboptimal. I think what we all really want is to live in a world where our governments have come together to agree on a process that we agree with and we feel is consistent with our values. And so I think this case illustrates one of the many circumstances where tech companies are being caught in the middle of governments and law enforcement and the individuals and companies and consumers that they serve. And I think that's not the place we want to be. And that's not really where we want to start in terms of finding solutions.
All right. Thanks to the three
Thank
of you. Brad's
Thank
going to
you.
Be back up in a minute. But before we call our second panel up here, a few comments from a practiced eye who looks at this with a practical bent. This case, when finally resolved, obviously is going to be studied in classrooms as well as in boardrooms and government offices. Among those who wanted to comment today, Professor Ed Lazowska of the University of Washington. You'll see him on the screen.
I'm Ed Lazowska. I've been a professor of computer science at the University of Washington for 37 years, a long time. The group of people who signed on to this brief are a set of senior computer scientists who are experts in the design of large-scale distributed systems. So these are people who are, in many cases, responsible for, or at least deeply familiar with, the technologies that underlie the cloud. The goal here is to help the courts understand the technology that underpins the cloud, this abstraction, and to let them make the legal decision. So I think there are several points we try to make in the brief. But the important point from, as I understand it, from the point of view of this case, is the data, my email messages that are in the cloud, exist in some location or perhaps several locations. It's not just out there somewhere, it's in a data center. The system knows where those are. So that's really important. It's not on my PC, but it exists somewhere. Secondly, there's no really new technology. What's in these data centers are 10,000 single board computers, each of which has a processor, some storage, a disk drive, some flash memory, a network interface. Nothing magic here. It's not in the cloud. And those seem like really important points. Third, most companies treat my documents and my email as my property, not the company's property, not some abstract entity's property. That's mine in both a legal way and a technical way. A legal way because the terms of service that the cloud provider has offered me make it clear that it's my data, not their data. And technically, it may be encrypted, for example, or something like that. At the very least, there are layers of protections applied to keep people other than me from accessing that. And that's particularly important because in many cases, multiple companies, sometimes competing companies, may use the same cloud provider. As I understand it, and from reading the court decision, the question of whether the data is located in a specific place is of importance in determining the outcome of this case. What I can say authoritatively, and what my several dozen colleagues have also said authoritatively, is that data is in some known place. If the U.S. government wanted to get access to the contents of someone's room in a Hilton hotel in England, just because Hilton is a U.S. company, they couldn't say to Hilton, hey, open that room and rummage through it for us and see what you can find. The laws of England would presumably govern the access to that room because that's where the room resides. And I think of that as being a reasonable analogy for the location of cloud data. It's in some physical place, and I would presume that the laws of that physical place govern access. So those are really, I think, the three key points. It's in a specific physical location. The technology is what we're used to. It's scaled up a lot, but it's memory and disks and processors. And what I put in the cloud is mine by the terms of service and the technology.
I would love to be able to ask him questions about exactly that, but you're going to be the people who'll get them instead. Our second panel consists of three individuals representing three different organizations, each of which has filed or is filing an amicus brief expressing concerns that this case could undercut privacy rights of individuals, and each group approaches this from a different perspective. With us is Nuala O'Connor. She is president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Faiza Patel, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and Bruce Brown, who is from my old field, who is executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. I just want to come to the title of your organization at the Brennan Center. It is your co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program. So on the liberty aspect, I'm sure you're concerned with Microsoft's position. On the national security aspect, you ought to be concerned about the government's position as well.
Well, I think that's right. But I think, as was explained in quite some detail in the previous panel, it's not as if the government has no way of getting this data. There is a mechanism for getting this data, which is the mutual legal assistance treaty that they have with Ireland. So it's not a zero-sum game where either Microsoft gets its way and the government gets no information, or the government wins.
You keep referring to, and the other panel did as well, to these mutual assistance treaties
right.
that exist with government. What if the data center was in a country with which we didn't have an MLAT, as they're referred to?
Mm-hmm. Well,
because there are countries with which we do not.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, first of all, as I think Brad pointed out, it depends on where a company chooses to put its data centers, whether it's in a country that has a developed legal system and with which we have relations. But realistically, you don't have to have an MLAT in order to get cooperation from another country to get data. There are lots of other longer, older ways in which you can get this information. And there are very few places in the world where the United States government isn't going to be able to get cooperation in a normal case, which is what we're talking about here.
Nuala, why is your organization filing a brief?
We're concerned about the individual whose data is at issue here. Think about the baby pictures you're seeing for your new granddaughter and all the emails I sent this morning to my kids' teachers and the babysitter and the 18 other emails I sent before you all got up this morning. These are my communications, and we don't even just think of them as property. We at the Center for Democracy and Technology think of this as the digital self. Your expression, your daily lives, it's not just going to be email. 10 years from now, it's going to be every thought and every communication and every transaction I do will be online. That's not a business record. That's my life.
No, but Nuala, look, it's all out there. I know that in polls, Americans say we're very concerned with our privacy rights. But so, too, do we know it's all out there. You put your credit card number out there 6 times a day, and now you even add the security number, which I don't understand quite why it's a security number, because you're telling it to everybody. It's out there. It is available. And frankly, I'm not worried about the government coming in and taking my granddaughter's baby pictures. That doesn't concern me.
They all
You're welcome to them. I'll show them to you.
I know. I know you will. I know you're looking at them right now. But today it's your granddaughter's baby pictures. Tomorrow it's something else. It's your, you know, God willing, I don't even want to go to what it could be. It's
you don't know me that well.
I've done my research. It's all online, right? This is about the sanctity of your communications with each other, your family, your community, the companies with the good brand names you do business with online. But even more, it's about the blurring of the lines between the individual's communications with corporations and the community and the government. The default setting for all of the technology in our daily lives cannot be that everything is going to end up in the hands of the federal government. That should not be the presumption. That wasn't the presumption when it was paper letters stuffed under your bed. It cannot be the presumption for email. We have to keep that separate. And new technologies, as I think Andy Pincus said so well before, don't change the principles of the law. They change the fact pattern. And it's not just changing our relationship as the U.S. government with other countries. It's changing the relationship between the government and the self. And that's a fight I'm willing to take on and keep fighting.
And Bruce, does it impact substantially freedom of the press?
Well, this is a really important case for freedom of the press. We joined a brief along with your old pals at ABC and dozens of news organizations that are up on the screen here, authored by Laura Hanman, who's here today. And the case hits on a number of cylinders for us. You know, one, we see it as the digital analog to the Jim Risen case, which has been fought now for 8 years. The government's in court tomorrow deciding whether or not to call Jim for trial testimony. And that case has raised public awareness about issues surrounding reporters' privilege. This case is the digital analog to that because we hope that it raises public awareness about issues surrounding the security of everyone's communications in the cloud, but particularly reporters and news organizations are watching this case and involved in this case because we have stuff governments around the world want. And this case may not have been about journalism, but the next case will be. And for us, being a part of this case is therefore essential to ensuring that whatever gains we as an industry may make if the government backs down from Jim Risen, as it looks like it intends to, whatever extra tweaks we get in media subpoena policy from the Attorney General before he leaves office, we want to make sure that all of those advances are protected. And if the government uses this kind of end run in this case involving Microsoft, we have great concerns that the next case involving journalism could see a similar maneuver from the government. And the second thing I would say is that I think this case is incredibly important for the media and the technology industries in terms of their collaboration with each other. That the technology companies are so important to journalism today. They platform on the front end and distribute our content. On the back end, they're creating virtual newsrooms for us. And the fact that the two industries are working together in a case like this, I think is incredibly important for the future development of First and Fourth Amendment law.
And in a case where a reporter, Reporter X, who's working for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, has got a very important story that involves malfeasance, for instance, let's say in the Minnesota government. I don't mean to pick out Minnesota, but I just take it as an example. Almost all of the communications now, going back to my day, it would be face-to-face in terms of talking to sources. But now it's almost all done by email.
Right. I mean, the fact that to be a reporter today, working sources not just locally but internationally, storing email in the cloud. I mean, news organizations, I think, in the post-Snowden, post-Ryzen era are taking every precaution they can in terms of data security protection. But for us, it's essential that the gains we're able to make, as this Attorney General leaves office, and it looks like he's recalibrating in some very important ways, that those gains then aren't lost if the government starts using other tools, other mechanisms that could impact journalism down the road.
You know, let me come back to your argument. I'm hung up in my head about the pictures of the grandchildren. Because...
You want to get one show? Yeah.
No, but because... I actually don't even carry any. But because I'm not worried about that, because I'm not worried about the humdrum of the daily stuff that I exchange in emails, at some point you have to trust. And in this world that we live, where everything, as I said a moment ago, is out there, it seems to me at some point the government that you elected, you have to trust to be judicious in what it will go after. And given the fact that it is all so easily obtainable, hackers get into it all the time, we basically have to put our faith in somebody, don't we?
Really? Listen, I love this country. I served at the Department of Homeland Security. I was the first chief privacy officer there. I believe in what we do to keep this country safe. I want my children, I want your grandchildren to be safe. Absolutely. We've got great men and women working in law enforcement and national security. However, they have to
be... I had
be,
a feeling it was going to be a button in the sentence.
There have got to be rules, and the rules have got to be followed. And just because the technology allows us unfettered access into the voluminous amount of data that is out there about people's daily lives does not mean they should have unfettered access to it. And this case is part of a larger national conversation. You were right to bring up Edward Snowden. We are really looking hard as a country at where the boundary is between ourselves and the government. And the presumption in the United States always has been that is what is mine, until there is a legal predicate for the government to come a-calling and asking for it. And in this case, they haven't proven that they need access to this data. There's got to be a compelling public policy or legal interest in getting that data. And again, the bulk data collection issues that we're working on in Washington show that the presumption cannot be that everything just goes to the government, and then they get to look at it, and then they get to figure out what is necessary. That's not the America my parents brought me to, and that's not the America I want my children to grow up in.
Let me come back to the Snowden case, because it's an interesting one. Would we be having this discussion today? Would this be as much of an issue if Snowden hadn't told us the way NSA was able basically to get everything in real time, unencrypted?
I think we actually would. We've been seeing a number of cases come up through the legal system, going through the Supreme Court, the case about GPS tracking, the case about search incident to arrest that was discussed on the previous panel. You're seeing these cases kind of percolate up through the legal system, where the courts are being faced again and again with rules that are made for the physical world and to try and adapt them for the virtual or digital world. And so I think we would be having this conversation. I think what's unique about the Snowden moment is that public attention is very sensitized to invasions of privacy in a way that it wasn't prior to Snowden. And so that adds an extra dimension to the conversation.
So let me flip the question I just asked Nuala. I kept saying at some point we have to trust. But it basically did Snowden show us that we can't trust anybody? The government, the large companies who gave them the access, et cetera.
Can I jump in and say?
Please.
I I do trust the Supreme Court after the last few decisions in technology. I think FISA's absolutely right that what this shows, and Snowden certainly catapulted us forward probably about 5 or 10 years in the conversation, but we were going to have the conversation about the increasing use of technology, our increasing connectivity and through the digital world. We were going to have that conversation eventually, and we were going to have the conversation about what's in the private sector and what's in the government's hand and whether those are blurring data sets. But I do see, I have hope. I am actually one of the most optimistic people in Washington, actually. I have probably more hope for the court
That's
than
one.
For Congress. That's me. I'm alone in that. I have a lot of hope given what we've seen out of the Supreme Court in the last few technology cases. Andy Pincus and the Center for Democracy and Technology, we have all filed amicus briefs in a number of these cases. And the court has a growing realization that the old rules still apply. So just because it's new and different and we can get more data does not mean we need to abandon our fundamental principles of privacy and individual liberty.
Even though it was Microsoft that called this thing together, and even though there are Microsoft people in the room, rank the Microsoft arguments for me. What is more troubling to you? The fact that the that the government is going after material in Ireland, or is it the fact that the government maintains that these are business records and not private communications?
Well, I think the extraterritoriality argument is really troubling. And one issue we haven't mentioned here yet today is the right to be forgotten, which the EU imposed on companies like Microsoft, Google, Yahoo. And just last week, they said, well, it's not enough that you honor takedown requests in the EU. You need to honor mm-hmm. them across your whole network. And so think about that. If we reach into Ireland to grab these emails, how can we then say that the EU can't reach into Mountain View and Redmond and tell Microsoft and Google to honor these takedown requests from EU citizens? And so I do think that the this larger question that this case and others addresses about efforts of governments to reach across state borders is one we would be having regardless of Snowden, because I think these kinds of cases would be materializing to the internet now that we're, mm-hmm. we're, you know, 10, 15 years, 20 years into internet publishing. These are the kinds of cases that are now materializing.
Let me ask the same question to you about the two arguments that, that Microsoft
So I think
makes.
It depends on what perspective you're coming from. But from the perspective of where I sit, I would say two things are the most troubling for me about the government's case. One, which was covered extensively in the first panel, was this idea that emails are business records, because as was explained many times, emails are the record of our lives. Some would argue more than that. And the government isn't just trying to get at emails, it's also trying to get at all of the other information that's stored in this individual's account. So that could include your contact list, your photographs, whatever else you've loaded into the cloud, which can be a great deal of information. And I want to just mention one thing about your earlier point, right, where you said you weren't worried about the government coming after your granddaughter's or grandson's photographs. And I think that's probably right, but I think we've also seen in the past that these kinds of authorities can and have been abused, and particularly if you are not right in the mainstream of society and if you are, for example, an activist, or you're somebody who's organizing protests, there are a lot of incentives for government to come after your information. You look at the protests that are breaking out across the country now, you know, the Ferguson, Eric Garner protests. Do you think law enforcement doesn't want to know what's going on in those protest movements? Sure they do. And if they could get that information, sure they would. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind when you talk about very broad government surveillance. The other point that I wanted to make in terms of what's most disturbing to me about the arguments that the government is making in this case is the idea that the search and seizure doesn't occur until somebody in the government sitting here in the United States actually looks at the documents.
Right.
That has enormous implications, right? It's sort of like saying, well, I can collect the emails of everybody in this room, everything in all of our accounts, and until somebody from the FBI takes a look at them, I haven't done anything that relates to the Fourth Amendment. That's a sweeping argument and one that really needs to be pushed back
against. But it's the argument that distinguishes between a physical piece of paper or some sort of document or something that somebody has to go into Ireland to get, mm-hmm. as opposed to simply a document which can travel through the cloud and be on your desk at the, within seconds.
Well, but the argument isn't even so much about where, it's about when, right? So in this case, they're conflated, that the when and the where are the same. The documents are being retrieved at the point at which they're being retrieved, not at the point that somebody back in the United States is actually looking at them.
Although the court said there is no search and seizure overseas, it occurs here.
Well, that's precisely
that.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, building on what Faiza said, I completely agree that the government is torturing the definition of the words collection and search. And, you know, to collect it and to have access to it means the government could do something with it, could process it. But I see you struggling with the analogy between paper and digital, which is interesting because we often in tech use analogies to previous versions of the same content so that people will understand. Because I always use, you know, party line telephone as an example of people to understand what Twitter is and trying to make analogies for other new technologies. The content is what matters, right? It's not the physical form, whether it's on paper or whether it's in the cloud. If I'm writing to my spouse or my, you know, again, my child's teacher or my lawyer, that's privilege. That's a communications. That's a one-to-one communication. And that's just because I've used a different technology, I've used an email service provider, does not necessarily mean that I have given up my expectation of privacy in the content of that.
So am I putting words in your mouth that the argument about privacy versus business records is more disturbing to you than location?
For me, that's profoundly offensive to describe my personal transactions. And again, whether it's in my personal capacity or my work capacity, they are my communications with another. And simply by virtue of using an email service provider, I do not abdicate my sense of privacy about that.
Okay, so we did with the last panel, so I make you king for a day. How do you solve this problem? Is there a way to solve it? Is it to be done legislatively, or is it to be done judicially?
First, I would echo what some of the other panels have said, and that there are actually processes in place. And for the Justice Department to complain that the MLATs don't work fast enough, well, I'm not entirely sympathetic to that argument, and they've also asked for $24 million in additional funds, which we are very supportive of their getting to strengthen those processes that already exist.
You're going to write the check?
Personally, yes. Absolutely. First, you're all going to donate to CDT, and then write the check. How's that?
I never miss a moment.
CDT.org. Get your checks in by the end of the year for tax deductible purposes, 501c3. Legislation, sure. There's also a role for good companies of all the big brand names that we are aware of and do business with this holiday season to have good rules in place and to explain to their customers when you're doing business in this country, your expectation of legal coverage is this. There's also technological solutions. You brought up encryption. I'm a great believer in if technology created this problem, then technology can be part of the solution. That the great minds we have working in engineering, again, in Seattle, in Silicon Valley, elsewhere, can come up with solutions that say, I will have an expectation of privacy, I will know where my data is, I will be able to follow it, I will be able to understand as an ordinary customer whose rules apply, who's going to have their hands on it. But again, the big picture issue to me here is the data that I do business with in my private capacity, whether it's as a mom, as a working person, whatever, does not mean that I say it's okay for the federal government to see whatever it is, whether it's my social media profile or my personal communications.
Faiza?
So I think legislation would be very helpful in solving the U.S. problem. But I don't think it's just a U.S. problem. It's not just an American problem, because it is a global problem. And one of the issues that has come out in this case is the difficulty that an American corporation would have if a government overseas asked for information that's sitting in the United States, right? So you really do need to have some kind of international agreement that takes account of the various national interests that are involved. So you have the interest of the country that wants the information, you have the interest of the country where the information is stored, and you potentially have a third country of interest, which is where the person whose information you're looking for is from, right? So you could have as many as three parties. And I think at the end of the day, the international community has to come together to figure out how you balance out those interests and what the most efficient way is for making this process work quickly. We have found ways to do that in the past. We do it in a number of different areas, banking, for example. You know, there's a lot of work that goes on which is transnational, and this requires a transnational solution.
So you have hopes that we can agree it's Monday.
Afternoon.
And well, I was going to say, since Dula and Faiz have talked a lot about the international and global perspective, one thing I would just pitch is that we just keep on working on the DOJ. And in the year and a half since disclosures came out about the subpoena, the secret subpoena to obtain AP phone records, and then the grab for emails at Google owned by a Fox News reporter, we've been talking regularly with the DOJ on these press subpoena and search warrant policies as part of the new guidelines that the AG issued in February. He has now established a permanent news media DOJ dialogue group, and we've met once with the AG and his top staff, and then the lawyers have been continuing to talk throughout the year, and we hope that when there's a new AG in place that there'll be a transition and that will continue. And in some ways, that dialogue was modeled after what the Aspen Institute had run for years as a dialogue between press and national security people, and they used to convene annually out in Y, Maryland. There's been some talk about doing something like that again, and I think the table looks different now because it's got to include technology companies as well. And I think that that process of having regular contact and dialogue with the DOJ, we have found, has borne some fruit this year. And I think as even as we think globally, thinking locally down on Pennsylvania Avenue in the DOJ, I think makes some sense too.
All right. Well, thanks to all three of you. As I said at the outset, this is an important case, and that's why it warrants this kind of discussion. As Professor Lisowski said, these are just emails and servers and age-old privacy questions, but new technologies like the cloud do change the landscape. Governmental attorneys have their imperatives, and Microsoft and those who are filing amicus briefs today have their imperatives. I, for one, am awfully glad I'm not a judge and have to parse these competing needs. But we'll get a final word now. Thanks all for coming. Brad Smith.
Well, let me just close by saying thank you to everybody in the room and thank you to everybody who is watching on the web. I think that Charlie Gibson actually framed these questions amazingly well. As you heard, the technology is new, but the principles that are at stake really are not. And the fundamental question is whether governments or companies or others will do things simply because they can, or whether we'll think through the principles that we want to see endure. And fundamentally, there are two very important questions at stake. Will your emails get the same kind of protection as your paper mail or your telephone calls or what you might put in a safety deposit box in a bank, or even what you might leave in your hotel room while you're out and about in a city during the day? Or will instead that protection be lost? That is a question of fundamental importance. The other thing I thought Charlie put amazingly well was this question: should we feel comfortable trusting our government? Well, actually, I would say this case is about whether people will have the opportunity to trust their government. Because this is about email in Ireland, and the Irish people don't get to vote in U.S. elections. The German people don't get to vote in U.S. elections. And if there comes a day when the British government, for example, seeks to obtain email that is stored in a data center in the United States, we'll all be reminded that the American people don't get to vote in British elections either. So ultimately, this case, among many other things, is about whether people will have the right to have their email protected by their own laws and their own governments and their own constitutions. That's at stake, too. As this conversation this morning showed, it's a big issue. At times, it's a complicated question. But more than anything else, we need not just problems, but we need solutions. And it's conversations like this that we hope can move us forward. As we look to the new year, the case will move forward, but we hope the conversation will broaden and move forward in new ways as well. Not just here in court in New York, but in Congress and in the executive branch in Washington and in national capitals and in international dialogues across the Atlantic and around the world. Hopefully today takes us one step farther. Thank you very much.